नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवतीर्वोत्तम श्लोके भक्तिर्भवती नैष्ठिकी कृष्णाय वासुदेवाय देवकी नंदनाय च नंदगोपकुमाराय गोविंदाय नमो नमः। ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानांजनशलाकया चक्षुरोन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूप कदा मह्यं तदाति स्वपदान्तिकं। वन्देहं श्रीगुरु श्रीयुतापदकमलं श्रीगुरून् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजाता तान्वितं तां सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनासहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधा कृष्णपदान् सहगणललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च। हे कृष्णा करुणा सिंधु दीनबंधो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिका कांत राधा कांत नमोस्तुते। तप्त कांचन गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये। वांछा कल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिंधुभ्येव च पतितेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे। We were to discuss the arguments between Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the Buddhist Guru. After we discuss that, then we will actually further proceed in that pastime. So Prabhupada has written a long purport. We will just describe the same purport. So Prabhupada explains that there are, according to the Buddhist cult, there are two ways of understanding philosophy. One is called Hinayana and another is called Mahayana. There is not much explanation beyond that, what exactly is the difference between Hinayana and Mahayana. And then Srila Prabhupada explained that the Buddhist philosophy is based on 9 principles. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in his argument with the Buddhist cult, he basically defeated these 9 principles, the foundation principles of Buddhist philosophy. So the purport essentially talks about how these 9 principles, foundational principles of Buddhist philosophy, have flaws. So one of the lessons which Prabhupada gives is that he says that actually we cannot understand the Supreme Lord by logic. Logic is insufficient. Simply by word juggling logic, one can never come to the conclusion about the Supreme Lord. Achintya kaluye bhava natam starkena yojayet. But here we see that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu defeated the Buddhist philosophy by argument. And there is an important lesson for all the ISKCON preachers. So these Buddhists actually they do not have faith in the authority of the Vedic injunctions. So Mahaprabhu defeated the Buddhists by logic and argument. Mahaprabhu did not actually quote any scripture verses from the Vedas, because Buddhists anyway don't believe in the Vedic authority. So that means we can see that Mahaprabhu, just by putting forward strong logic and reasoning, he defeated all their arguments. So Prabhupada's instruction is that, so therefore, preacher should also learn to actually put forward logic and reason. Because many times people don't have authority in the Vedic scriptures. So we will have to put forward logic and reason to defeat them. So those who are preachers in ISKCON will certainly meet many people who believe in the intellectual arguments. Most of these people don't believe in the authority of the Vedas. Nevertheless, they accept intellectual speculation and argument. Therefore, the preachers of Krishna consciousness movement should be prepared to defeat others by argument. So Mahaprabhu put forward such a strong argument that the Buddhists could not counter him to establish their cult. So now we will take up each of those 9 foundational principles of Buddhists and what were the arguments given by Srila Prabhupada in the purport to defeat those principles. The first principle of Buddhism is that the creation is eternal and there is no need to accept a creator. So Prabhupada in his purport, he gives 4 arguments to actually defeat this point. First point is that actually he relates with the 6th principle of Buddhists. The 6th principle of the Buddhist philosophy is that the principle of nirvana or annihilation is the ultimate goal. So now when you compare the first principle and the 6th principle, first principle is creation is eternal, but the 6th principle is nirvana, annihilation is the ultimate goal. So when you say creation is eternal, then you cannot, then how can you aspire for nirvana as ultimate goal? Because there is not going to be annihilation. So in that way, Prabhupada says, he's finding contradiction. If this were the case, there could be no theory of annihilation. But the Buddhists maintain that annihilation is the highest truth. So there is a contradiction between the first and sixth. And the second argument is that by practical experience, we see that in this world, things have a beginning, middle, and an end. By practical experience. Then it is definitely contradicting with this foundational principle that everything is eternal. And the third argument is that the aim of Buddhist philosophy is to dissolve the body. This is proposed because the body has a beginning. So they say that the ultimate goal is to dissolve the body. So if this body has a beginning, then how can you say that similarly the entire cosmic manifestation is like a gigantic body? Similarly the entire cosmic manifestation is a gigantic body. But if we accept that it always exists, there can be no question of annihilation. Therefore, the attempt to annihilate everything in order to attain zero is an absurdity. Actually, this is same as the first point, actually. The first point is that if creation always exists, then how can you say that the ultimate goal is actually annihilation? I think the same point is conveyed here. The ultimate aim of the Buddhist philosophy is to annihilate or dissolve the body. But if the first principle says that everything is, the universe is going to remain eternally, it's an, creation is eternal, then how can you aspire for the annihilation? So that is the same point which is explained. And then the next point, we can say the third point which Prabhupada says is that by our practical experience, we have to accept the beginning of creation. And when we accept the beginning, we must accept a creator. So we see that everything has a beginning by our practical experience. So that means there is a beginning, that means there must be somebody who created it. Oh, this is the third argument. These three arguments are given by Prabhupada to actually dismantle this point. So therefore, the conclusion is that the cosmic manifestation is certainly created at a certain time, and the creator, there was a creator who existed before the creation. And that creator is not a created being. He is actually beyond this, beyond the creation. And that creator is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is the conclusion, the first point. The second argument, second foundational principle of Buddhism is that this world is false. So here Prabhupada explains that the world is temporary, but it is not false. Because when we go through pains and pleasures in this world, there is definitely, we have a practical experience of pain and pleasure. Yeah, we cannot say that these pains and pleasures are false. If you were to say that the pains and pleasures are false, then the creation would also be false. And that means nobody should pay any attention to the creation. If everything is false, then one should not pay any attention to the creation. So the point is that the conclusion of the material creation is not false, but it is temporary. We are not the body, we are the spirit soul, but still, as long as we have the body, the experience of pain and pleasures are real. We cannot say it is false. As long as we have the material body, the pains and pleasures are there. So, if you were to say it is false, then one should not pay any attention to it. One should not go to any hospital. One should not go to... When you are hungry, then you should simply say, it is a false feeling. And keep sitting like that. So, it is a... does not appeal like that. And the third principle is that they say that I am is the ultimate truth. I am is the ultimate truth. So that means they say that only I am only there. There's no second person. But Prabhupada gives a simple argument. So Buddhism is based on logic and argument. They are always actually doing different arguments using logic. For arguments, you need two persons, not one person. See, if I am is the ultimate truth, then how can you argue with another person? So... there must be, Buddhist philosophy depends on argument, but there can be no argument if only depends on I am. So that there must be a you or another person also. So the philosophy of duality, the existence of the soul and the super soul must be there. So here Prabhupada quotes this Natvevaham Jatunasam to show that how there are eternally so many living entities and the Supreme Lord, they are all eternally existing. It's not that only one person is there. And the fourth principle of Buddhist philosophy is that transmigration of the soul. So they also talk about transmigration of a from one body to another body. But the point is that they do not properly explain about the next birth. So they don't, Vedic scriptures talk about 84 lakh species of life, and when a person, one will accept a body from one of these 84 lakh species of life in the next life. But the Buddhism, they simply talk about transmigration, but they don't properly explain it. That's what Prabhupada explains it. The principle of the soul is eternal and it exists in this body or in another body. Even in this lifetime, we experience existence in a child's body, youth's body, etc. And after the annihilation of the body, we acquire another body. And the fifth principle of Buddhism is that Buddha is the only source for knowledge. He is the only source for the attainment of knowledge. So Prabhupada gives two arguments to refute this. He says that we cannot accept Buddha because Buddha rejected the Vedas. And he says that one must accept a principle of standard knowledge because one cannot attain the absolute truth simply by intellectual speculation. So Buddha, especially we don't worship Buddha because he rejected the Vedas. The fourth point, only that's the point he explains.
But then Prabhupada doesn't present any argument. He just says that, you know, they do not properly explain, he says.
Yeah, only that much he says.
That's all only?
So for the fifth point, Buddha is the only source for knowledge. The first argument which Prabhupada gives is that we cannot accept this because Buddha rejected the Vedas. And the second argument which Prabhupada says is that, like, if, so okay, these people are saying Buddha is the authority. Somebody else may say that such and such person, X, is the authority. So in that way, if we say that if everyone is an authority, if everyone accepts his own intelligence as the ultimate criterion, then the scriptures will be interpreted in many different ways according to that person's authority. So anybody can claim that his opinion is the supreme. So different people, there will be so many claims that our opinion is the supreme. So then this will be, we cannot actually, these people say Buddha is the only source of authority. Somebody else may say that this person is the only source of knowledge. So this doesn't, this will lead to actually so many conflicts. So there has to be one standard authority that should be based on scriptures. So that is the point he says, that this will lead to the philosophy of yato mat tato bat. This has become a very great problem, and everyone is interpreting scripture in his own way and setting up his own basis of authority. Now everybody and anybody is trying to establish his own theory as the ultimate truth. And the sixth point of the Buddhism is that Nirvana is the ultimate goal. Nirvana is the ultimate goal. So for that, Prabhupada explains that actually, as soon as we accept a material body, we must accept the fact that the body will be annihilated. Jatasya hi dhruvam rutyur, dhruvam janam mrutasicha, tasmat apariharyarite, natvam shochitam argasi. As soon as there is birth, death will be there. So if all material bodies are doomed to annihilation, we must accept a non-material body or a spiritual body. if we wish the next birth to be anything but false. So the Prabhupada's main point to this sixth principle is that he says that the highest goal is not simply to actually, is not nirvana or simply annihilation of the body, is to get a spiritual body. According to Buddhists, the highest goal is simply to actually annihilate the material body. They don't have a positive goal of getting a spiritual body. But the highest goal according to Vedanta is that to get a spiritual body and return home back to God. This is the main point which Prabhupada explains. It is not that perfection means one's existence becomes void or zero, but actually the existence continues. If we positively want to annihilate the material body, we have to accept a spiritual body. Otherwise, there can be no eternality for the soul. So when they say that highest goal is to actually have annihilation, that means they are actually disagreeing with the eternality of the soul. But according to the Gita and the Bhagavatam, the soul is eternal. Therefore, we cannot simply annihilate the soul. We have to get a spiritual body where the soul can actually live peacefully.
Right now we have material body and we are conscious and we are undergoing suffering. And the suffering, why is it arising? Because there is desire. Desire is the root cause of all evil. And they say that when one dies, because of the desire, the atoms and molecules in the body, again they reform a body because of the desires with which we die. And then it is reformed again, it takes on another body. Like a wheel, which has a hollow in the middle, you know, around it the spokes are all placed. So the according to them, the material elements are placed around void. So that is the understanding. But the wheel cannot move without the axle. You know, so the axle is like the soul. So they consider the wheel. Have you ever seen a wheel on its own moving? So they don't consider, because the axle which is fitted into that hub, you know. And then the wheel can be used as a bullock cart or anything like that. So assuming that there is a void within, but the material elements are just formed around it, and we are dismantled, again mantled, again dismantled, again mantled. So they say that when your desire turns towards zero, it gets dismantled and it doesn't take on another shape. This is their understanding of reincarnation. But actually this is not the philosophy of all the Buddhists. In the Buddhists also, they have a Theravada Buddhists. They are the only ones who adopted this no soul doctrine. Even if you meet some Buddhist monk, if you ask, almost 60-70% of them accept the presence of the soul, amongst them also. But the one category of people who are like a hardcore Buddhist, they are against anti-Hindus, they are anti-Vedas. So they wanted to say something against the Vedas. Oh. Vedas say there is soul, they will say there is no soul. Like that, they came like that. So that is why this point Prabhupada says here, which you said just now. If all the material bodies are doomed to annihilation, we must obtain a non-material body or a spiritual body if we wish the next birth to be anything but false. Yeah, they say that this body is false and then the suffering is coming. Their wrong imagination is when desires will tend towards zero, when there will be non-existence of the material body, that time you go to nirvana, where you will not have suffering. So that is the kind of understanding they have, because they don't know who they are. Because the soul means identity. Like you said some few arguments ago, as soon as there's an argument, there are two conscious living entities with two different opinions. But their argument against that is, they say that one is a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is enlightened state. Oh. In a state of enlightenment, there is no argument. Uh-huh. But prior to enlightenment, whoever is in an entangled state, the arguments arise due to illusion. Uh-huh. So they say that the one soul has permeated all the bodies, and then the arguments come in those where there is a defect or deficiency. When all the defects are rectified, you attain Bodhisattva, where one becomes an enlightened one. That kind of idea they have. Very close to impersonalism. One greatness of impersonalism is they don't say Shunya. They say Brahmam Satyam, Jagat Mithya. Shankaracharya at least very strongly established that truth. Here Buddha had to deny the... when I was reading that book, Stephen Rosen, the one reincarnation, he says Buddha never said there is no soul. In fact, one of his students asked him about no soul thing. He scolded him also. Oh. When did I say there is no soul? He asks like that. He has given a quote in his book also.
Oh.
But the subsequent followers have made this Theravada or no soul doctrine, he says.
Oh.
So in this way, if they say there is no soul, it is a very, very low-class philosophy.
Oh.
Because not only he doesn't accept the Vedic injunctions, besides rejecting Vedas, they reject the very existence of an individual. At least impersonalists consider the soul to be God, and the qualities, at least in quality, it is one.
Mm-hmm.
But this is this kind of non-acceptance of the soul, anatmavad we call it.
Mm-hmm.
This anatmavad is actually very, very low class. And, and because it doesn't give any scope for bringing the right arguments and truth.
In the Stephen Satyaraj Prabhu, he has written about these philosophies in detail. Okay.
The black color book. You must
okay.
Is there, no? Yeah. In that book, if you take Buddhism section, he has given a quote that Buddha never denied the soul.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there is a quote in the Buddha's writings where Buddha is scolding one of the disciples. Why do you decode a wrong meaning that I am saying there is no soul, like that he is asking.
Mm.
But the way he speaks about nirvana, it makes the students decode it as no soul.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, just like sometimes when we talk about oneness with Krishna, some of the people say, hey, Prabhuji is speaking Mayavad. And they will think like that. Later on you have to clarify to them, it is not Mayavad. There is oneness and difference, we clarify. Same way when Buddha was giving a talk, some of his disciples concluded there is no soul.
Oh.
You know, when they spread the word, then Buddha corrected them.
Hmm.
Yeah, he gives a quote on that.
Oh. And the seventh point is that Buddhist philosophy is the only path. The fifth was that Buddha is the only source for knowledge. And the seventh is that Buddhist philosophy is the only path. Here Prabhupada just mentions one point. He says that actually we cannot accept the Buddhist philosophy because there are many defects in the philosophy. The perfect philosophy means it should not have any defects. And he says the perfect philosophy is the Vedanta philosophy because nobody can point out any defects in the Vedanta philosophy. And therefore we conclude that Vedanta is the supreme philosophical way of understanding the truth. This is the only refutation which Prabhupada gives is that because Buddhist philosophy has many faults, therefore we cannot accept this point. Buddhist philosophy is the only path. And the eighth point is that Vedas are compiled by ordinary human beings. So here Prabhupada gives, I think just two or three points. The first thing he says is that if you were to say that Vedas were to be compiled by ordinary human beings, then they would not be authoritative. But people actually accept Vedas as an authority. Then how can you accept an authority like they are to be compared with ordinary human beings? So the second point is that actually it is mentioned in the Vedas that Lord Brahma was instructed in the Vedas. Tene Brahma Hridaya Adikavaye. So it is not that the Vedas were created by Brahma, although Brahma is the original person in the universe. So Brahma was actually given the Vedic knowledge. So if even Brahma did not create the Vedic knowledge, who is called as the first created being, then from where did the Vedic knowledge come from? That means it must have come from the Supreme Personality of God. Because there was nobody, like there was no person in the beginning of the creation other than Brahma. And also it is mentioned that Brahma did not write the Vedas, he did not compile the Vedas. So therefore the conclusion is that the Vedas were not created by any, were not written by any created being. It has come only from the Supreme Personality of God. Supreme Lord means he must be without the defects. He must be without the four defects. So this is the point which Prabhupada gives. And then finally he explains that the authority of the Vedic knowledge is accepted even by Shankaracharya, who is an Avaishnava. Of course, he just mentions for the sake. Shankaracharya is a Vaishnava internally, but although he is accepted by authority by Shankaracharya, although he is not a Vaishnava. So these are the points which Prabhupada gives. Main point he says is that if Vedas were written by human beings, they would not be considered authoritative. And the second point is that Brahma is mentioned as the creator of the Brahma is mentioned as that person who has been instructed by the Vedas in the beginning. If even Brahma did not compile the Vedas, who is the first created being, that means the conclusion is that it must have been created by the Supreme Lord who created this material world. So therefore, it is refuted that Vedas were not written by any ordinary humans, but it was coming from the Supreme Lord. And the ninth point is that
my implicit faith, because apaurushaya, when we say it is not written by any human being, and that is stated in the Vedas itself, like, you know, karma brahmodbhavam with the brahmakshara samudbhavam, you know, the Vedas are coming from they were breathed out by the Supreme Lord. So when we hear the Vedas in Guru Parampara, first we have some faith in the Guru and from whom we are hearing. And then when we hear these words, we accept it as a gospel truth. You know, because there is no mundane way to prove it. One thing we could say is, Vedas are giving a kind of knowledge which is humanly not creatable. No ordinary, because there are so many fields explained in the Vedas, and all of them are becoming true, even from the modern man's point of view. So the soundness of the message can be appreciated now. But other than saying that, when we say that Brahma didn't write it, and Brahma only received it, and Brahma handed over in parampara. So this requires some amount of implicit faith. And so somebody can say, no, I don't believe it. Somebody says, I believe it. But those who put some initial faith, over a period of time, they reap the fruits, benefit. And those who, in the beginning only, those who are chucked out because of lack of faith, they keep slogging and rotting in the world.
There's just one point which I remembered in this connection. The Tattva Sandarbha commentaries, Jiva Goswami explains, like some people, they actually give this argument. When we say that Vedas are eternal, Vedas are coming from the Supreme Lord, this we say based on the statements in the Vedas only. So some people say that, therefore, like, you want to prove that Vedas are eternal, it is coming from the Supreme Lord. And in order to prove that, you are only quoting from the Vedic statement only. Therefore, some people say that this is a particular defect called as what you want to prove. For that, you are giving an evidence which depends on the proof only, which depends on what you want to prove. So he says this is called, gives a particular term, but in English it's called a circular reasoning. What you want to prove, for that the evidence which you give, that is dependent on what you want to prove. So people give this argument that, this is a circular reasoning, you want to prove that Vedas are eternal, but for that you are quoting from the Vedas only. So Jiva Goswami gives a counter argument. He says that, like, suppose if there were to exist a book which tells that okay, Vedas are eternal. If you were to depend on some other book to show that, oh, Vedas are eternal, then that means that implicitly, okay, if there isn't such an authority, that means, like, implicitly that book is actually superior to the book of the Vedas. Huh. So then he says that, then you need to know the authority of that particular book. So then, in order to prove the authority of that particular book, so then another book too, that is saying that, oh, this book one is authoritative. So that means indirectly, then you will say that, oh, that means that book two is superior to book one. Then you want to go to that. In this way, there'll be no end to actually, you'll keep on going to other books. So the fact that in order to, we are not depending on any other book apart from the Vedas to understand that Vedas are actually eternal. If you were to depend on something else, that means it would lead to actually some other book being superior. So he says that the fact that we are depending only on the Vedas shows that it is free from circular reasoning. That's what he, this is the point he explains in the. And of course, that point, it requires implicit faith. And the more we apply the teachings of the Vedas, and we can experience it.
When I talk to students, I make this argument that the Vedas, have been speaking. Vedas never work hard to, prove that we are the authority. Hmm. They just tell the truth because the word Veda means knowledge. Prabhupada says in the Ishopanishad, and it has been coming from the dawn of creation. Hmm. And they don't make efforts to prove themselves. But they do tell truths which are indefeatable truths. Hmm. Like, for example, in science, the theories are updated, revised, modified, and the old theories are thrown out of the window. Hmm. We see that. But in Vedas, it has never happened that we are very sorry to announce that there is no soul or something like that. They said soul exists millions of years ago, and now the same knowledge applies. Although modern man had denied it long ago, and he was going on. But now the reincarnation is becoming proven, not only amongst Indians, all over the world. Hmm. People are recollecting their previous, if there is something called hypnotic regression and all that. So which means the various researchers in the field of science is proving the truths given in the Vedas, which actually were not accepted by scientists for a long time. Hmm. So that is one thing which we use amongst the students to show that empirically also Vedic truths are becoming proven and the scientific knowledge is rendered inferior. In front of our eyes. Like you can see in India, people started with organic food, went to fertilizer food, now they're back to square A, organic food. People lived in villages happily, now they went to towns, cities, now they're coming back to villages now, coming to farm communities like that. So people ridiculed yoga and all these things to be useless waste of time, Then they got obesity and all those, now they're coming back to yoga. So we can show that people who deviate from Vedas suffer, and those who align with Vedas flourish. And the modern man is also trying to align. So this is how we prove it. This is a very, elementary way of proving it for those who are faithless. But those who have more natural faith, they can develop implicit faith based on, studying the Vedas and seeing the results they get by the sincere practice.
So the ninth principle is that, so Buddhist philosophy, they say that pious activities such as showing mercy, simply showing mercy, that is what the advice of the Buddhist philosophy. Showing mercy, that is advice in the Buddhist philosophy. That for them, actually, that is the highest, we can say, sadhana. Like being good to others, do good to others, like something like philanthropic things. So Prabhupada gives Prabhupada gives three arguments to this. First point he says is that actually this kind of showing mercy is a relative thing. It's a very relative thing. Like we show our mercy to somebody who is subordinate to us, like who is suffering more than ourselves. But if there is a superior person, then we cannot say that I want to show mercy to you. We become the object of mercy from him. So therefore, simply when we say showing mercy, cannot be the absolute truth. It is just a very relative truth. Rather, we are the objects of mercy from the superior person. So therefore, first argument Prabhupada says is that this showing mercy is a very relative thing. It is not the absolute truth. The second point Prabhupada gives is that we have to know what actually mercy is. When a person is sick, you have to know like what it means to actually do good to the person. If we give something which is forbidden for him, and then we say that we are giving mercy to him, then it will cause it will be a cruelty for him. So therefore, unless we know what really mercy is, we may create an undesirable situation. And the third point Prabhupada gives is that actually, because Buddhist philosophy does not admit the existence of the soul only, then the so-called mercy of the Buddhists is defective. So there is no soul, so then there is no person. How can you say that there is actually showing mercy? So these are the three points which Prabhupada gives. I heard some long back. Once you were sitting with? Acha. Acha. Yeah, better we know authentically before, of course. We don't want to. Yeah, we should know authentically, but even if it is true, then we may not sometimes speak openly or something. If it creates agitation. So then we'll go ahead. Then after the. Even if one is like, we have to know authentically whether it is true. And even if it is true, sometimes if we speak the truth, if it is going to create agitation, if it is going to create a wrong this thing in others, then we may not actually speak with the names, but we may just tell that some people say that their philosophy is non-violent, but they speak. They may eat meat like that. Without naming, we can actually use them.
Buddhists and all. In this particular case, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu spoke nice arguments and all. But the Buddhists, they supplied him this plate of non-vegetarian thing. Mm. Of course, Lord Chaitanya is omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. So the eagle took it up and fell and all. So I had a question. With such kind of elements in society who are very much anti-Krishna consciousness and they will not appreciate about this thing. So should devotees also try to preach to them? Because it seems it may even involve life danger, isn't it? Or just keep a long distance from them and let them be what they are. Because Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took bold steps in a few places. Mm. One place is that Chandkazi, arguing with him based on Quran. Mm. Similarly here, defeating Buddhists very nicely. Mm. Prakashan says they won't do any harm. Mm. They were proper. They would only, see, we should have philosophical war. That is acceptable. But if somebody becomes physical, you know, these people became physical. Uh-huh. They are trying to feed him non-veg, saying that Mahaprasad or something like that. So basically their intention is not to defeat the philosophy.
Hmm.
Their intention is to finish the person only.
Mm-hmm.
So my question was, should devotees, if they get a chance to defeat such kind of philosophies which are very much against Krishna consciousness, like this philosophy, it's opposed to even soul, you know, and it has no basis. It is rejecting Vedas. It is rejecting soul. So such kind of people, if you come across, should we defend our movement by presenting to them? That was one question I had.
Yeah, in fact, I think it's mentioned in one of the verses itself. Mahaprabhu says that actually the Buddhists should not be even should not be seen. That verse came. No? They are unfit for discussion and should not be even seen by the Vaishnavas. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu still spoke to them just to decrease their false pride. So, in one sense, I think it's mentioned in the verse. Yeah, if they can become violent, then in one sense, we can better avoid, actually. We can maybe protect the innocent people who may get influenced by the Buddhists. Because there is not that there is no dearth of actually preaching. There are so many other people who can get influenced by the Buddhist philosophy. We can try to preach to them and about the mistakes in this philosophy. Unless somebody really becomes open and he comes forward, then we can preach to them. Otherwise, yeah, definitely the principle, we can avoid the envious people. Well, we are supposed to avoid the envious. So we can keep a distance.
We know our philosophy is best, but time and place is not suitable for us to prove that. So in that sense, should we take a backside, or just as Prabhupada is saying, we should, if at all it is against, then as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did, you should also have your stand.
Prabhupada is definitely mentioning that we should be trained in the logic and argument in order to defeat. But still, the point here is being made is that Mahaprabhu definitely defeated them in the argument, but after, also they were defeated, but they were trying to, in a sense, trying to feed like meat to Mahaprabhu. Like in one sense, it was it seems there was a little violent nature. So suppose if they are going to do something like that, you have to eat this. If you don't eat, they're going to like beat you or something like that. Or if they try to do something physical, will we be in a position to actually deal with them? So that was the point, actually. Definitely the principle, like, we should be able to defeat, we should be sound in logic and argument present. But still, some people, even if you use the right arguments, and when they get defeated, their ego becomes so much hurt, and then they can go to the extent of actually becoming violent. So then, from that point of view, we may avoid them.
Such a scenario, the quantity of the followers matters. Just like if we are, means we are 10 people, and suppose someone comes and he is against our philosophy, so of course we may take over him, you know. So if they are more, just like fighting generally, young
people. Yeah, that's
people,
also there.
So that's why I said about time, place, circumstances. If you are in that situation where you can have your good backup, so should we pursue or not?
Yeah, then we can pursue. But even in that, like how we put forward the argument, that is also the sense. We have to be always careful that they should be clear that we are mainly dealing with a particular philosophical point and not with the person. So we should put forward, we should mainly deal with the particular philosophy and not try to make sure that we don't hurt the person. That we have to always keep in mind. And yeah, this is a point, like recently I think one devotee was saying that they were coming from some particular place. So in the train, in some particular station, so there was some people from this Nirvana, Nirakar, some organization is it? Nirankari Baba. So many people actually boarded the train, boarded the compartment. Practically the whole compartment became filled with these people. And this devotee was coming with few devotees from some yatra or something. And so that devotee was saying that these Nirankari Baba people, they started actually preaching heavily to other people, etc. So many like groups of people are there, and even if you defeat and if you know that they are going to be a little violent or something, then better we keep a safe distance.
Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also, when he heard how Chand Kazi is creating trouble, he told everyone, you come, we'll attack. Means you will backfire. So actually, means in one sense, we'll backfire him. So that made a great impact on Chand Kazi also. When he saw so many devotees coming with mrudanga, mashal, so it had some effect on Chand Kazi, and he became a bit, you know, nervous seeing that. So it's not a violent act, but of course, many times we may have to take stands, because otherwise they may consider us defeated. We are defeated in front of them. Like
yeah,
that.
We have to see the time, place, and circumstance. The sense, like even during Bhaktivedanta manner, when the temple was about to be closed, then all the devotees together and the other Hindu organizations, they put forward a petition, they came. So it had an impact. But like that protest was also, I don't think they were going to physically attack Chand Kazi or something. Like that unity of the people, that coming together, that actually created.
Sometimes, Prabhuji, there is a direct attack by some of the different religious leaders. It happened, you know, before also. So what is the stance? Because they directly, you know, attack. And it's in YouTube, Facebook, you know, they fill.
Definitely we have to defend, in a sense. And people trying to harm the devotees, harm their temples. So we have to definitely defend. Prabhupada also told, like when there was attack on the New Vrindavan community in Mayapur, Prabhupada told the devotees to take up some measures to counter attack, like to defend them. So it is required.
It's okay, as you said, we have to defend definitely. But the question is in regard to like philosophical word is there. So suppose I have good position also, I have, means quantity of disciples are also there, people are also there. But what is the purpose of, means arguing? Is it to defeat him only or to make him devotee? Because if I know that he is like argumentative, if I defeat him also philosophically, he is not going to be devotee. So should I waste my time, spend my time to argue with him or just go ahead?
See, again, sometimes we have to see the particular circumstance. Sometimes, like we may by we may speak to that particular person, that person may be adamant, he has already decided not to accept. But there may be other people who are watching it, watching the conversation. But the way we actually deal with that particular person, the way we actually put forward the arguments, others can become influenced. So when Yamaraj spoke to the Yamadutas, the Vishnudutas spoke to the Yamadutas, Yamadutas, they did not get convinced even after Vishnudutas spoke the glories of the holy name. In fact, when they went to Yamaraj, what they had in their mind was that they wanted to kill, arrest the Vishnudutas. That's what they expected from Yamaraj. But Ajamal, by seeing the conversation between them, he became transformed. So sometimes we have to see that particular situation.
A situation like, as you said, if it is public assembly, other people are also involved. And it's not only me personally, us, but they are questioning our philosophy. Or so if I have to defend my philosophy also, attack, and this is a philosophical attack. This is fine, but personally we are going like book distribution or other places. So as we heard that, okay, this person just went to book, he's just arguing and just spending time. So we just go ahead, just ignore him. Like, what to do in that case?
Yeah, we have to see again in book distribution, sometimes the focus is actually distributing books. Like sometimes we may keep on arguing with the person and then we lose their time. We could have approached other people for selling books. So, in book distribution, is mainly to distribute books. And somebody is not interested, then we approach more people, approach other people.
By train, just in my opposite seat, the person came and just neighbor seat. We just started talking, discussion, and argument. So in that case, means I am not, my focus is not book distribution also. I'm just sitting on my maybe personal study. He's just disturbing me. So what should I do in that time? Should I argue with him and defeat him or just...
So that's not in the sense. It's a black and white answer. In the sense, we have to see the principle of defending the philosophy that is definitely there. So when you initially speak to that person by trying to defend, then after some time you will get the pulse of the person, whether he's actually open-minded or he simply wants to actually prove his point, although he may tell the right points.
Okay. I was wondering, how are you going to tackle that fellow? Yeah, you could have easily told him that, don't disturb, get out, Instead, you gave an answer and that fellow became very favorable after that, Very, very handled with a very cool head, And he was satisfied also. You told about, having a rock solid philosophy could be, even the terrorists have rock solid philosophy, you say. Immediately, that was clean, bold, He could not speak any further. On one hand, his fallacious logic was exposed. On the other hand, you did it respectfully. So he became favorable. He came and offered your business before going. That's a practical demo of today's question.
Yeah, we'll go ahead. So, which verse is it? 63, 64. So after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu influenced all the Buddhists, after they became Vaishnavas, Mahaprabhu suddenly disappeared. Then he arrived at Tirupati and Tirumala. So there he took darshan of the 400 form of Lord Venkatesh. So Prabhupada gives a description of Tirupati temple. He said there are many temples in South India, but this Balaji temple is specially opulent. A great fair is held there in the month of Ashwin, September, October. And also there are two more temples, Govindaraj temple and Ramachandra temple. I think they are in the Kodandaram temple. are there in the bottom of Tirupati. So Mahaprabhu visited those two temples also. 66th verse. Swaprabhave loka sabar karana vismay. Pananar singhe aila prabhu dayamay.
Everywhere Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went, he influenced astonished everyone. He next arrived at the temple of Pan Narasimha. The Lord is so merciful.
So this is a place called in Mangalgiri. So 1999 we had gone a South India Yatra to these places, Mangalgiri, Kovur, Simhachalam. So Mangalgiri, there is a Panaka Narasimha. So it is explained that when you offer Panakam to this Narasimha Dev, Lord would take half the Panakam, then half would be remained. Half Panakam is a jaggery and some elaichi made out of the drink. So I think it's if I remember that they offer the pan, if you offer the, you can directly offer to the deities, half would you drink and then half would be remaining in the glass. That's what somebody told. And Prabhupada explained that there is a conch shell in this temple, and this conch shell was presented by the king of Tanjore, and it is said that this conch shell was used by Krishna himself. This is the Loka Pramana according to the temple history. And then Mahaprabhu, after worshipping Narasimha Dev there, so people were astonished to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's influence, and then he came to Shiva Kanchi. Of course, it is not mentioned in the chronological, because Mangalgiri is in Andhra Pradesh, and it is actually little much ahead of Tirupati. It's almost, I think, overnight journey, no? at least four or five hours from Mangalgiri to Tirupati. And Shiva Kanchi is like little in Tamil Nadu. From Tirupati, it's about 2 hours. So Mahaprabhu came to Kanchipuram. In Kanchipuram, there are two parts, Shiva Kanchi and Vishnu Kanchi. Kanchipuram is also called as the city of temples, Kumbakonam, Kanchipuram. So there are very huge temples are there, Shiva Kanchi. So Mahaprabhu visited the temple of Lord Shiva. By his influence, he converted all the devotees of Lord Shiva into Vaishnavas. So the way Mahaprabhu actually converted people into Vaishnavas is that he gave them the experience of actually the bliss of the Harinam Sankirtan. He gave them the experience of actually the bliss of devotional service. By that they became actually influenced. They started chanting the holy names. Or in some places he would have a debate, or he would actually argue. But most places in South India, he actually did Harinam Sankirtan, and by that he preached to people, just by simply doing Harinam Sankirtan. Prabhupada explains in one purport in the Jadabharat Rahugan Samvad, says how Mahaprabhu preached to different people. In the South India, he preached mainly by Harinam Sankirtan, and to people like Prakashanand Saraswati and Sarvam Bhattacharya, he had a philosophical conversation. So similarly, we should adopt that kind of method like the Prabhupada says. So then Mahaprabhu visited Vishnu Kanchi. Vishnu Kanchi, of course, in Kanchipuram, within a vicinity of Shard, there are something like 13 or 14 Divya Deshams are there. Divya Deshams are there are 108 Divya Deshams of Sri Vaishnava Sampradaya. So these Divya Deshams are those deities of Lord Vishnu, which were sung by the alwars of Sri Sampradaya. So in Kanchipuram itself, I think maybe more than a dozen Divya Deshams are there. One of the main temples is Varadaraj temple. And Mahaprabhu came there, and he also took bath in the Ananta Sarovar, and he stayed there for 2 days in Vishnu Kanchi. And people, by seeing him, they became devotees of Lord Krishna. So then Mahaprabhu came to Sri Kalahasti or Trikalahasti, which is near Tirupati. and there he went to the temple of Lord Shiva, which is called, there Lord Shiva is called as Vayulinga Shiva. And then Mahaprabhu came to a place called as Pakshi Tirtha, which is also called as Tirukadi Kundam. Tirukalungundam? Oh, okay. Oh, Tirukalugukundam. Oh, okay, okay. So that's why Prabhupada explained that since time, there are two eagles would come there. Since time immemorial, it is said that these two eagles are coming to actually take prasadam. And it is said that, only that's what is explained, there is a temple of Lord Shiva, and Lord Shiva's deity is called as Veda Girishwara. And then Mahaprabhu came to Vriddha Loka, Vriddha Kola, Vriddha Kola, and he visited the temple of Shweta Varaha temple. Vriddha Kola, I don't know what is the present name. One name is Sri Mushnam. It is located about the 1 mile south of an oasis known as Bali Peetam. So then Mahaprabhu came to a place Chidambaram. Chidambaram is in Tamil Nadu. So Chidambaram is near actually Kadalur. So there also Mahaprabhu visited a temple of Lord Shiva called as Akashalinga. And 74th verse. Shiali Bhairavi Devi Kari Darshana Kaveri Ratire Aila Shachira Nandana.
Visiting the temple of Shiali Bhairavi, a form of Goddess Durga, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the son of Mother Sachi, went to the bank of River Kaveri.
So this is the Durga temple in the Tanjore district, Shiali Bhairavi temple. So it is described that there was once a small boy who was a devotee of Lord Shiva who came to the temple, and then Durga, that is Parvati Devi, she actually fed her breast milk to the small boy. So Mahaprabhu came, took darshan of the Durga temple, and he took bath in the Kaveri river. And then he came to a place called as Go Samaja. There also he saw a Lord Shiva's temple. So there are so many temples of Lord Shiva which Mahaprabhu visited. And Go Samaja is near Vedavana. 76th verse. Amrita Linga Shiva Deki Vandana Karila Sabashivala Yeshaiva Vaishnava Haila.
Seeing the Shiva deity named Amrit Linga, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu offered his obeisances. Thus he visited all the temples of Lord Shiva and converted the devotees of Lord Shiva into Vaishnavas.
Then Mahaprabhu came to a place called as Devasthana. So there he talked with the Vaishnavas of Sri Sampradaya. And then he came to a place called as Kumbhakarna Kapala, which is known as Kumbhakonam presently. I think Shivananda Shyam Prabhu is that particular place. So Kumbhakonam is actually near like Tanjore, or called as Tanjavur. And Kumbhakonam also, there are so many Shiva temples. There are 12 Shiva temples are there, and then I think 4 Vishnu temples, Prabhupada explains in the purport. Mayapur Panjadatta deities. So Kumbhakarnam, and then Mahaprabhu, in Tanjore, Mahaprabhu visited one of the famous Lord Shiva temple. It is called as Brihadeeswarar temple. This also, many people come to visit the like, architectural wonders of that. Pariya Koil, yes. Brihadeeswarar. There must be definitely, I think, there's a story. We have to do some more. Kumbhakarna Kapala. It's known as Kumbhakarna. So then, then Mahaprabhu came to Papanasha, Papanashanam, and then he finally arrived at Srirangam. So Prabhupada gives a detailed description of Srirangam. So in regards to Papanasanam, Prabhupada says that there are actually two holy places known as Papanashana. One is actually in the district of Tirunelveli, which is actually much further, much away from actually Srirangam. And another place is actually near Kumbhakonam. So here the Papanashana which is referred to being is like that which is near Kumbhakonam. Then finally Mahaprabhu arrived at Srirangam. So Srirangam, for this is the largest temple in India, and there are seven roads leading to Srirangam, and Prabhupada gives an explanation of like different alvars of Sri Sampradaya. He mentions about Andal. Andal is one of the alvars of Sri Sampradaya. She is actually directly the consort of Lord Ranganath. She married the Ranganath deity and then she entered the body of the Lord. And there is another Alvar, Thirumangai Alvar. You must have seen the drama. He actually built the fourth, the seven walls of the temple. He built the fourth wall, fourth boundary wall of Srirangam. And also there is another Alvar called as Thondarodipadi Alvar. Thondar means devotees. Adi means the feet of the devotees. Podi means the dust. Means like one who always stays at the dust of the lotus feet of the devotees. Thondarodipadi Alvar. So he, although he was a great devotee, once he became infatuated to a particular prostitute. But Ranganath became very sad that my devotee is forgot my service, he is attached to a prostitute. So in order to bring back his devotee, so Ranganath himself arranged that his personal paraphernalia, one golden plate of the deity paraphernalia, he arranged that to be put in the house of the prostitute. And then the kings actually they came and found that. So when the golden plate was discovered missing from the temple, there was a search and it was found in the prostitute's house. When the devotees saw Ranganath's mercy upon this prostitute, his mistake was rectified, and then he then prepared the third boundary wall of Ranganath temple. That much is explained. And then so Prabhupada gives some more explanation, some more history of the Ranganath temple. How Muslims, when they attacked the Srirangam, they killed 1200 Sri Vaishnavas. At that time, the Ranganath deity was transferred to Tirupati, and then later from Tirupati, the deity was transferred to a place called as Simha Brahma. And then finally, again the deity was brought back to Srirangam. So there are many stories associated with them, but would not actually go into those details. So then Mahaprabhu, when he came to, so in Srirangam, so Venkata Bhatta and his family, they requested Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to stay at his house for the 4 months of the Chaturmasya period. So Venkata Bhatta, so Prabhupada explains that because his surname is Bhatta, so therefore he must not be an inhabitant of Sri Rangakshetra. He belonged to the disciplic succession of Sri Sampradaya, but he came from some other place and settled in Srirangam. Because usually the inhabitants of that province do not retain the name Venkata. It is therefore supposed that Venkata Bhatta did not belong to that province, but he may have been residing there for a very long time. So at the request of Venkata Bhatta, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu stayed at his place. So now there is the famous pastime of that South Indian, that Brahmana comes. So we'll just briefly describe that pastime. So every day when Mahaprabhu would be performing Sankirtan there, people would come and simply by seeing Mahaprabhu, all their happiness and unhappiness and distress vanished. And many people, they started chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So in this way, the population was completely astonished. And every day Mahaprabhu would get invitation from different Brahmanas. And for the 4 months, he went to different Brahmanas' houses. And many Brahmanas did not get a chance to invite Mahaprabhu. So many people were inviting, but not everyone got a chance. And in that holy place, in the Srirangam temple, there was a Brahmana Vaishnava. He would come to the temple and then every day recite the verses of the Bhagavad Gita. So 94th verse. Ashtadashadhyaya pade anande aveshe. Ashuddha padena loka kare upahase.
The Brahmana regularly read the 18 chapters of Bhagavad Gita in great transcendental ecstasy. But because he could not pronounce the words correctly, people used to joke about him.
So, but despite the, although people criticized him, but still he did not care. He would regularly, every day recite the Bhagavad Gita and was personally very happy. So this pastime, of course, you have heard many times, but I'll just mention some lessons from this pastime and we'll read a few verses. And this Brahmana, he did not care for the criticism and he was every day reading. And he was exhibiting ecstatic symptoms. Pulakashru Kampashveda Yavad Patana. And by seeing these ecstatic symptoms, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu became very happy. So here we can see that this Brahmana, he was not good in pronunciation. So Prabhupada would always say that pronunciation, and there are some of the disciples, Prabhupada's lady disciples, they were not chanting the Isopanishad mantras properly. Some Brahmanas, they said, these people are not able to pronounce properly. And Prabhupada said their pronunciation may be imperfect, but the renunciation is perfect. So this pastime shows that the pronunciation of the verses, that is not the important thing. Of course, we definitely try to do that as far as possible. But the point here is that what is important is the attitude or the devotion of the Brahmana. So because although this Brahmana was not able to pronounce properly, by his devotion and attitude, he was actually exhibiting the ecstatic symptoms. He did not pronounce the words properly, but experienced ecstatic symptoms. And also we see that another point is that when you take to Krishna consciousness, there will be always some people who will ridicule you. This Brahmana was laughed at by many other Brahmanas. But because he was absorbed in Krishna, he was not affected by the ridicule. So we devotees will also be ridiculed by others, but to the extent we are absorbed, then we will not be affected by others. And then we can see another point is that this Brahmana was exhibiting ecstatic symptoms simply by reading Gita. That means in one sense, just Bhagavad Gita itself is sufficient to give one pure love of God. It is not that unless you read the gopis pastimes or other things. So even simply by reading Bhagavad Gita, that itself is sufficient to get pure love of God. Like the flute sound which emanated from the mouth of Krishna, from the same mouth Bhagavad Gita was also spoken. So then Bhagavad Gita is also the flute sound of Krishna. And then another point here is that sometimes this Brahmana, what to speak of understanding the technical details of the subject matter, he did not even know how to pronounce the verse, but still he actually experienced the ecstatic love. So one thing we have to understand definitely as far as possible we try to understand the different technicalities, different connection between the verses, etc. But the ultimate purpose of all those things is that we have to enter into the feelings of the personalities involved in the pastime. So this Brahmana, when Mahaprabhu asked that, how is it that you are having such you are exhibiting such ecstatic love, which portion of the Gita is giving you such transcendental pleasure? This Brahmana said, actually, I'm an illiterate person. I don't know the meaning of the words. I'm reading the Gita because I've been ordered by the spiritual master. So we'll come to that point.
Sound of Krishna. Huh. So prior to that one point you made.
Gita itself is sufficient to give pure love of God. Bhagavad Gita itself is sufficient to give pure love of God. So, Shyamanand Thru was telling in one class, was saying that when Krishna closed his eyes, when Putana came to kill Krishna, when Krishna immediately closed his eyes. So it is described that Radha Govind Maharaj explains some 21 reasons for why Krishna closed his eyes. Then Shyamanand Thru said, all these 21 reasons, we try to definitely understand them. But then he mentioned, but even if you don't know all these 21 reasons, but if you know that Krishna is so merciful that he gave the position of a mother, the person who came to kill, even if you know this much, that itself is sufficient to actually, by meditating on the quality of Krishna's mercifulness, then you can actually get love for the Lord. So what he emphasizes is that, even if we know all the commentaries of the acharyas, but if we are not entered into that actual, the merciful nature of the Supreme Lord, the heart of the Supreme Lord, if you have not entered into that, then we may not actually experience that particular pastime. We may just know, intellectually know all those connections, but if you have not entered into the feelings of the persons involved, we may not experience the actual fruit of reading the scriptures. But here, in the case of this Brahmana, he did not know any of the technical understanding of the scriptures. But this Brahmana is saying that whenever I open the Gita, the thing which comes to my mind is that Krishna is acting as a chariot driver for Arjuna. Just by seeing this particular picture of Krishna, how he is acting as a servant of his devotee, and I am unable to control my tears. Something like that he says. While seeing Lord Krishna sitting in a chariot and instructing Arjuna, I am filled with ecstatic happiness. Actually, I only see Lord Krishna sitting on a chariot as Arjuna's charioteer. Taking the reins in his hands, he appears very beautiful and blackish. So he has not maybe understood the technical details of the scriptures, but he has definitely entered into the feelings of Krishna's love for Arjuna, how Krishna is acting like a Bhakta Vatsal. So by that he is actually able to experience the love for Krishna. But the most important point is that this Brahmana, he followed the order of his spiritual master. Because he followed the order of the spiritual master, so we can understand one point, that if somebody who does not know anything to read or write, but just because the spiritual master told him, he is actually reading it daily, so then we can think from our own point, at least we know the language, we can at least read. So then there is no, why should we actually not read it regularly? Somebody who is an illiterate person, who does not know how to read or write, but still he is actually reading. So then there is no excuse for us actually to not read these books. So Prabhupada quotes this particular verse 2 times in the 2 purports. Yasya deve para bhaktir yata deve tata gurav tasyarte katita kyarta prakashante mahatmana. So one who has unflinching faith in the Guru and Krishna, to him all the imports of the scriptures are revealed. So then when this Brahmana told this point, that I am simply seek Lord's beautiful features, it is for this reason that I am reading the Gita and my mind cannot be distracted from this. 102nd verse. Prabhu kahe Gita paate tomara ei adhikara. Tumi se janiha ei gitara artasara.
Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told to Brahmana, indeed, you are an authority in the reading of the Bhagavad Gita. Whatever you know constitute the real purport of the Bhagavad Gita.
So Mahaprabhu himself is actually giving a certificate that you are the real authority on the Gita. Whatever you know constitutes the real purport of the Gita. So there are 5 or 6 rewards obtained by this Brahmana because of his following the instructions of his spiritual master strictly. The first reward is that this Brahmana saw Krishna in the pages of the Gita. He said, whenever I open the Gita, I don't know how to read or write, but I only see this particular picture of Krishna. He saw Krishna in the pages of the Gita. And the second reward this Brahmana obtained is that he got a direct certificate from Lord Chaitanya that you have understood the real purport of Gita. The third reward is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu embraced this Brahmana. And the fourth reward this Brahmana got is that this Brahmana understood the tattva of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He understood that Lord Chaitanya is non-different from Krishna. So the 104th and 105th verse is explained that Brahmana is saying that by seeing you, my happiness is doubled. So I take it you as non-different from Krishna. And the fifth reward which this Brahmana got is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself taught this Brahmana Gita. Explained in the 106th verse. Tabe Mahaprabhu Tandra Karaila Sikshan. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then taught the Brahmana very thoroughly. Then the sixth reward is that this Brahmana got the association of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for 4 months. For all the 4 months. So he became a great devotee of Mahaprabhu and for 4 continuous months he did not give up the Lord's company. So these are the 6 rewards obtained by this Brahmana by following the instructions of his spiritual master.
I would give the name of the Brahmana, Yudhishthir.
Achha, he's Yudhishthir?
He referred from the diary of Govinda Karcha. They said that the name is written as Yudhishthir.
Oh, his name is Yudhishthir. Okay. Second point is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave a certificate. He himself said that you have understood the real purport of Gita. Yeah, we'll just take a break and we'll continue from the 109th verse. 108th verse. Huh? ಏಮತ್ತ ಭಟ್ಟ ಗೃಹೇ ರಹೇ ಗೌರಚಂದ್ರ ನಿರಂತರ ಭಟ್ಟ ಸಂಗೆ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಕಥಾನಂದ
ತನ್ನೆ ಮಹಾಪ್ರಭು ರಿಮೈನ್ಡ್ ಎಟ್ ದ ಹೌಸ್ ಆಫ್ ವೆಂಕಟ ಭಟ್ಟ ಅಂಡ್ ಕಾನ್ಸ್ಟೆಂಟ್ಲಿ ಟಾಕ್ಡ್ ವಿತ್ ಹಿಮ್ ಅಬೌಟ್ ಲಾರ್ಡ್ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಇನ್ ದಿಸ್ ವೇ ಹಿ ವಾಸ್ ವೆರಿ ಹ್ಯಾಪಿ
So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there is a beautiful conversation between Venkata Bhatta and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So they developed a very friendly relationship. Sometimes they would laugh and joke together. So one thing we can hear is that in this conversation, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would speak to Venkata Bhatta in a very friendly manner. After having spent few months, then he was speaking to Venkata Bhatta. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked Venkata Bhatta that your worshipable deity is the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi Devi, but she always remains in the side of on the chest of Narayan, so therefore definitely she is the most chaste woman in the entire creation. But why is it that although she is such a chaste wife, and why is it that she wants to associate with my lord, that is Krishna? And just to associate with Krishna, Lakshmi Devi abandoned all the transcendental happiness in Vaikuntha, and then she performed austerities for a long time just to get the association of Krishna. Then Mahaprabhu quoted this particular verse from the prayers of the Nagapatnis. 114th verse, we'll recite together. Kasyanubhavosyana deva vidmahe tavangri renu sparshadikara yaduvanchaya shri lalana charattapo vihaya kaman suchiram dritavrata.
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then said, O Lord, we do not know how the serpent Kali attained such an opportunity to be touched by the dust of your lotus feet. Even the goddess of fortune, for this end, performed austerity for centuries, giving up all other desires and observing austere vows. Indeed, we do not know how the serpent Kali got such an opportunity.
So here, this is a verse which shows that actually even Lakshmi Devi performed austerity to get the association of Krishna. Then Venkata Bhatta is replying. So he says that actually Krishna and Narayana are the one and the same personality. But the pastimes of Krishna are more relishable than the pastimes of Lord Narayana because of the sportive nature. Due to their sportive nature. And then the second point he says is that because Krishna and Narayana are the same personality, actually, you cannot say that Lakshmi Devi broke her vow of chastity by wanting to associate with Krishna. Because they have the same personality. So Prabhupada explains in the purport that Lakshmi's desiring to associate with Krishna was perfectly natural. In other words, it is understandable that a chaste woman wants to associate with her husband in all his different dresses. Therefore, one should not criticize Lakshmi for wanting to associate with Krishna. So in order to, then Venkata Bhatta quotes a verse to prove that how Krishna and Narayana are the same personality. So 117th verse. Siddhantastvat abedepi Shrisha Krishna Swarupayo Rasainot Krishyate Krishna Rupam Yeshara Sastitihi.
Venkat Bhatt continued, according to the transcendental realization, there is no difference between the forms of Narayana and Krishna. Yet in Krishna there is a special transcendental attraction due to the conjugal mellow. and consequently he surpasses Narayana. This is the conclusion of transcendental mellows.
So, actually, just a few verses later, like here Venkata Bhatta is quoting this verse, then later Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also quotes the same verse to Venkata Bhatta. In that purport, Bhaktivinoda Saraswati Thakur says that one may think of this verse is written by Rupa Goswami in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, but how is it that they are speaking this verse and much before Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu was taken? Then Saraswati Thakur says that it seems that this verse was there even before. The devotees would quote this verse even before, and the Rupa Goswami just took that verse, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. From where? It's not mentioned, like from where it is. That's what he says. 118th verse. Krishna Sange Parivrata Dharma Nahe Nasha. Adhika labha paye ararasa vilasa.
The goddess of fortune considered that her vow of chastity would not be damaged by her relationship with Krishna. Rather, by associating with Krishna, she could enjoy the benefit of the rasa dance.
So Venkata Bhatta, basically, Mahaprabhu's question is that your worshipable master is Lakshmi Devi, but why is she actually leaving the association of Narayan and wanting to associate with Krishna? That is the question of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Why did she perform so much of austerity after leaving Vaikuntha and wanting to have the association of Krishna? So Venkata Bhatta is replying by saying that actually Krishna and Narayan are the same personality. It is not that, don't think that Lakshmi Devi is deviating from her chastity by wanting to associate with Krishna. Well, any chaste woman would want to associate with her husband in all his dresses. So similarly, Lakshmi Devi wants to associate with Narayan even in the form of Krishna. Now in this verse, Venkata Bhatta says that Lakshmi Devi wants to associate with Krishna because she wants to enjoy the pleasure of rasa dance. She wants to enjoy the pleasure of the rasa dance. For this purpose, she wants to associate with Krishna. And Mother Lakshmi is also an enjoyer of the transcendental bliss. Therefore, if she wanted to enjoy herself with Krishna, what fault is there? So there is no fault in Lakshmi Devi. So please don't actually joke about this. Why are you joking about this? So there is one point which devotees actually, which I heard from Radha Gopinath Prabhu. Like sometimes there are certain instances, some devotees from ISKCON, like they went to some other devotees of Sri Sampradaya and they were like arguing based on like who is superior, Vishnu or Krishna, based on the scriptures. But so Radha Gopinath was saying that like here Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he is actually speaking to Venkata Bhatta, he is actually speaking in a very friendly manner. He is not in the mood of actually trying to defeat him or prove his philosophy or something. And that also, after spending some time with Venkata Bhatta, after developing a proper relationship with him, and then in a friendly manner, he was actually speaking this. So sometimes immature devotees, that they just want to actually defeat the people from the other sampradaya, they just want to keep arguing. So that should be avoided. So he explained. So then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu replies. Mahaprabhu says that actually I know that there is no fault on the part of Goddess Lakshmi. But the point is that even though Lakshmi performed so much of austerities to get the association of Krishna to enter the Rasa Leela, but she could not enter the Rasa Leela. Why could she not enter the Rasa Leela? So for that, as an evidence for how Lakshmi Devi could not enter the Rasa Leela, he quotes a verse spoken by the Uddhava to the gopis. Nayam shriyongunitantarate prasada Svaryoshitam nalina gandarucham kutonya rasotsavesya bujadanda grihita kanta labda shisham yavudagad vrajasundarinam.
When the Lord Shri Krishna was dancing with the gopis in the Rasa Leela, the gopis were embraced around by the neck of by the Lord's arms. This transcendental favor was never bestowed upon the goddess of fortune or to other consort in the spiritual world. Nor was such a thing was ever imagined by the most beautiful girl in the heavenly planet. Girls whose bodily luster and aroma exactly resemble the beauty and fragrance of lotus flower. And what to speak of the worldly woman, who may be very, very beautiful according to the material estimation.
So here, after mentioning this, then Mahaprabhu tells another point or another question. He says that, okay, Lakshmi Devi could not enter the Rasa dance. But we hear from the scriptures that the personified Vedas, they were able to enter the Rasa dance. If they were able to enter the Rasa dance, why could Lakshmi Devi not enter the Rasa dance even though she performed so many austerities? As an evidence for how the personified Vedas, they became the gopis and entered the Rasa dance, he quotes a verse from the prayers of the Vedas personified from the 87th chapter of the 10th canto. I think we had discussed that previously. This verse is also quoted by Rupa Goswami in the Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti section. When he describes the two types of Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti is that Sambandhanuga Sadhana Bhakti and there is Kamanuga Sadhana Bhakti. So Raganuga Bhakti means devotional service practiced by following in the footsteps of the residents of Vrindavan. The residents of Vrindavan are classified into two categories. One is the gopis of Vrindavan. Another is all the other devotees. So the devotional service followed by following the footsteps of the gopis is called as Kamanuga Sadhana Bhakti. Devotional service followed, practiced by following the footsteps of the other residents of Vrindavan is called as Sambandhanuga Sadhana Bhakti. So this verse is quoted by Rupa Goswami as an example for Kamanuga Sadhana Bhakti in the nectar of devotion. So then, when Mahaprabhu posed this question, personified Vedas could enter the Rasa dance, but why could Lakshmi Devi could not enter? When Venkata Bhatta replied, actually, I cannot enter into the mysteries of this behavior. 125th verse, this is a very important verse. Ami jiva kshudra buddhi sahaje astira. Ishwarera lila koti samudra gambira.
Venkat Bhat then said, I am an ordinary human being. Since my intelligence is very limited and I am easily agitated, my mind cannot enter within the deep ocean of the pastime of the Lord.
So Venkat Bhat, he accepted his limitation. Said, Ami jiva kshudra buddhi. And then he says, Tumi Sakshat Sei Krishna Jana Nija Karma. Yare Jana Sei Jane Tomar Lila Marma.
You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna Himself. You know the purpose of your activities, and the person whom you enlighten can also understand your pastimes.
So he is saying that. You know the purport of your activities. So Prabhupada explains in this purport, he says that the pastimes of the Lord cannot be understood by the blunt material senses. One has to purify the senses, then the Lord reveals himself. So now from 127th verse, on being requested by Venkata Bhatta, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explains the nature of Krishna and the love of the Vrajavasis till the 132nd verse. So Mahaprabhu says that Krishna has a very special characteristic. He attracts everyone's heart by the mellow of his personal conjugal love. Sva madhurye sarva chitta kare akarshana. This is especially the special characteristics of Krishna. And by this characteristic, Krishna attracted even the mind of Lakshmi Devi. That's why Lakshmi Devi wanted to actually enter the rasa dance. So then this is a special characteristic of Krishna. He attracts everyone by his sweetness, with the mellow of his conjugal love. But then from 128 to 132nd, in these six verses or five verses, Krishna, the Mahaprabhu explains what is the nature of the love of the Vrajavasis. Vraja lokera bhave paye tahara charana tandre ishvara kari nahi jane vraja jana.
By following in the footsteps of the inhabitants of the planet known as Vrajloka or Golok Vrindavan, one can attain the shelter of the lotus feet of Sri Krishna. However, in that planet, the inhabitants do not know that Lord Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
So he especially says that one has to follow in the footsteps of the residents of Vrindavan. So in that particular planet of Golok Vrindavan, somebody accepts him as a son, somebody may accept him as an intimate friend and may playfully climb on his shoulders. And they know Krishna as the son of Nanda Maharaj. And they consider that they can have no relationship with the Lord in the rasa of opulence. Then Mahaprabhu says that one who worships the Lord by following the footsteps of the residents of Vrindavan, they attain him in the transcendental planet of Vrindavan. Only they can go to Golok Vrindavan. So he is emphasizing the point that in order to attain the association of Krishna in Golok Vrindavan, one has to follow in the footsteps of the residents of Vrindavan. And then he quotes this verse from Srimad Bhagavatam. We'll recite together. Nayam sukapu bhagavan dehinam gopika sutaha jnaninam chatma bhutanam yata bhakti matamiha.
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then quoted, "The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, the son of Mother Yashoda, is accessible to those devotees engaged in spontaneous loving service, but he is not as easily accessible to mental speculators. To those striving for self-realization by severe austerities and penances, or to those who consider the body the same as the self."
So here, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives the actual answer. The actual answer Mahaprabhu gives is that the personified Vedas, they followed in the footsteps of the gopis of Vrindavan. So therefore, they could actually enter the rasa dance. They not only they followed in the footsteps of the gopis of Vrindavan, they were ready to assume the form of the gopis. They were not attached to that particular form as the personified Vedas. Because of these two reasons, following the footsteps of the gopis and assumed the form of the gopis, therefore they could enter the rasa dance. But in the case of Lakshmi Devi, because she did not follow in the footsteps of the gopis. Lakshmi Devi wanted to retain her opulence, spiritual body in the form of the Lakshmi. So therefore, she could not follow, she could not enter the rasa dance. This is the reason given by Mahaprabhu. 137th verse. Anya dehe na paiya rasa vilasa. Atayeva nayam shloka keha veda vyasa.
Vyasdev, the supreme authority on Vedic literature, composed the verse beginning Nayam Sukhapo Bhagavan, because no one can enter into the Rasalila dance in any body other than that of a gopi.
So it is explained that the word Nayam refers to that previous verse, Nayam Sukapo Bhagavan Dehinam Gopika Sutaha. Nobody can enter in the Ras Leela dance, anybody other than that of a gopi. So because that Nayam Sukapo Bhagavan, the word comes Yata Bhakti Matam Iha. Bhakti Matam means only for persons engaged in spontaneous devotional service, only actually to them the Lord is actually accessible. So in this particular purport, Prabhupada explains the same point, who can actually enter the Rasa Leela. So he says that one has to attain a spiritual body like that of a gopi in order to enter into the pastimes of the Rasa Leela. And then he also says that one cannot enter into Rasa Leela simply by artificially imitating it or artificially thinking oneself a sakhi and dressing up like one. So Krishna's Rasa Leela dance is completely spiritual. It has nothing to do with the material contamination. So therefore, no one can enter into this pastime by artificial material senses. So now Venkata Bhatta, he speaks. So previously, Venkata Bhatta thought that Narayana is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and Narayana is superior to Krishna. And previously, Venkata Bhatta thought that the worship of Narayana was a supreme form of worship and superior to all the other process of devotional service. So Mahaprabhu, he knew this misunderstanding of Venkata Bhatta. So therefore, in order to correct this understanding, Mahaprabhu spoke to Venkata Bhatta in a joking manner. Then Mahaprabhu continued, 141st verse. प्रभु कहे बट्ट तुमी ना करी है संशय स्वयं भगवान कृष्ण एत निश्चय
द लॉर्ड देन कंटिन्यूड माय डियर वेंकट भट्ट प्लीज डू नॉट कंटिन्यू डाउटिंग लॉर्ड कृष्णा इज द सुप्रीम पर्सनालिटी ऑफ गॉडहेड एंड दिस इज द कंक्लूजन ऑफ वेदिक लिटरेचर्स.
So you see that like so many other devotees, simply by Mahaprabhu, they simply by seeing that Mahaprabhu chanting the holy names, they became devotees of Krishna. Where in the case of Venkata Bhatta, like he had to speak and give us some philosophical discussion, but in a joking manner, in a rougher manner, in order to give him the understanding that Krishna is actually superior to Narayana. Then he said that Lord Narayan, the opulent form of Krishna, definitely attract the minds of the goddess of fortune and her followers. But Krishna is the original Supreme Personality of God. Ete chamcha kalapumsa, Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam. So the speciality of Krishna is that Krishna has got this four special qualities, that is Rupa Madhurya, Leela Madhurya, Venu Madhurya and Bhakta Madhurya. These are the four special qualities of Krishna. 145th verse. Tumi ye padila shloka sehaya pramana. Sei shloke aishe Krishna swayam bhagavana.
You have recited the shloka beginning with Siddhanta tastva abhedapi. That very verse is evidence that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
So actually, you see, Venkata Bhatta also quoted the same verse previously. But it seems that Venkata Bhatta quoted that verse without fully understanding the import of that verse. He quoted that verse to show that Narayana is actually non-different from Krishna, is non-different from Narayana. Only that much he quoted. But Mahaprabhu is giving one more higher understanding. Siddhanta, he also quotes this verse. And he says that according to transcendental realization, that means from the point of view of Siddhanta or Tattva, there is no difference between a form of Krishna and Narayana. But from the point of view of Rasa, Rasenot Krishyate Krishna Rupam Yesha Rasasthitihi. From the point of view of Rasa, devotional service to Krishna is superior to the devotional service to Narayan. So that is why when Rupa Goswami speaks Krishnanu Shilanam, by using the word Krishna, he is including devotional service to all the forms of the Krishna, all the incarnations of the Lord. By using the word Krishna, he is neither too exclusive nor too inclusive. He is neither too exclusive in the sense that he is not giving the point that only you have to render service to Krishna. He is including all the service to all the forms of the Lord. And he is not too inclusive in the sense that you serve anybody and everyone. It's not that Manav Seva becomes Madhav Seva. No. He's not too inclusive also. So, although he's accommodating service to all the forms of the Lord, but even in that accommodation, he is actually indicating the superiority of service to this form of Krishna over the forms of other forms of the Lord. Otherwise, he could have used some other Rama Anushilanam. So, by using specifically the word Krishna Anushilanam, he is also indicating the superiority of Krishna because of the point of Rasa Tattva.
Second time in Bhagavad Gita, later, in the 18th chapter. In that purport, Prabhupada says, I think one should not become official meditator or something. And then, but one very important point he makes, that devotees of Krishna don't even get distracted by meditating on the forms of Lord Narasimha and other forms, he says. So, one student was asking a question that, but Lord Narasimha, we pray every day, you know, and Prabhupada included it in the Mangalarti along with that program. Yeah, and Lord Narasimha is a protector and purifier. Mm. You know, anytime you go out anywhere in the car or train, you sing Namaste Narasimha. So, we are also asked to remember Lord Narasimha, especially in this age of Kali, where the evil forces are at, you know, are at great power, and devotees require protection also. So, but Prabhupada writes it in the Bhagavata purport that devotees don't get distracted even by such forms as Narasimha. Other forms are understandable, like the other Dashavatara form, Matsya, Kurma, or whatever he says. Narasimha, we give him a very special place in the altar also. So, why do we give a place in the altar and we say we don't remember him or something like that? So, he asked that.
Actually, I remember reading these three forms of the Lord are actually, I'm not remembering the reason, but these three forms are given especially special importance: Krishna, Ram and Narasimhadev. The Laghu Bhagavatamrita Rupa Goswami mentions these three forms are especially special. Narasimhadev, when Prabhupada is saying that one should not get, devotees of Krishna should not even divert their attention to other forms of the Lord, because it is based on Vishnu Chakotaka's purport. And that point is there. Still, from the initially, if somebody is inclined to worship some other form of Lord, like we may encourage, it's not a point, but still we can explain that how, from the point of view of the rasa, this form is superior. That devotee's question was that why Narasimhadev is given special importance.
We also make an effort to see him in the altar and remember him. In Mayapur, we also have Ugra Narasimha. In many of our temples, they have deity of Narasimha also, this much size, along with Lakshmi on his lap. So we worship his form, we meditate on his form also, and we try to remember him. So Prabhupada writes, we don't divert our attention to any of the Vishnu Tattva forms.
But I feel it is being made subordinate to the, like we worship Narasimhadev so that helps us to overcome the obstacles in our service to Lord Chaitanya, in our service to Krishna. Uh-huh. In a sense, it is actually being made subordinate to that worship of Krishna in our.
That is
so not in the sense of diverting our attention from Krishna. Mm-hmm. So that Narsingadev kills all the Hiranyakashipu like anarthas in our heart, so that we can actually divert our, so that we can focus on our attention to Krishna in a more solid manner.
Yeah, I think that is the correct point. I also feel that because there are many holy places like Ahobila Mandal, where the worship of Narsimha is so supreme. Hmm. That everything else becomes secondary, all other deities. So we don't worship Narasimha so exclusively like we worship Radha Krishna and Gaur Nithai. That is right.
So in the beginning he writes Om Namo Narasimhaya Namaha, all this.
Prabhuji, sixth canto also there is a reference of when Vishwarupa is Narayan Kavacha. So again, special importance, one verse come for Narasimhadev.
Okay.
That other, while creating also different deities name, then again emphasize given on Narasimhadev. So there Prabhupada writes what is importance of. That exactly I am not remembering, but there is.
Because especially, because in the material world, when we are engaging in devotional service, so many obstacles come. So we pray to Narasimhadev in order to remove the obstacles, in order to remove the anarthas, so that we can focus on our attention to Krishna in a more solid manner. Narayan. That temple was there like even before. I just maintained. Maharaj gave another explanation for the Lakshmi Narayan. He said, this Lakshmi Narayan is the form Krishna manifested in Paita. Paita is the like. In the Ras Leela, Krishna manifested the form of Lord Narayan. Alal Nath. Chaja. Oh, okay. Yeah, enjoy. Anybody? So Mahaprabhu quotes the same verse and he gives the, like previously Venkatabhatta quoted that verse in order to show that Krishna is non-different from Narayan. But Mahaprabhu is quoting the same verse to give the deeper meaning of that verse. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that this verse and many others like it were current among the devotees long before Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu was composed. Thus, devotees would always quote them and explain their purport in ecstasy. Then, as a proof of Krishna's super excellence over Narayan, so Mahaprabhu is saying that actually Krishna attracts the mind of the goddess of fortune, but Lord Narayan cannot attract the mind of the gopis. This proves the super excellence of Krishna over Narayan. And the second point he explains is that the proof of Krishna's super excellence over Narayan. For that, when Krishna himself appeared as Narayan, took the form of Narayan in the Ras Leela, when the gopis are actually searching for Krishna. That time Krishna himself took the form of Narayan. So that time the gopis were not attracted by the form of Narayan. They only asked him that, did you see Krishna going by this way? So this also shows that actually Krishna's form is actually superior to Narayan. Even Krishna in his Narayan form could not attract the gopis. So the two points he is explaining. One is that Narayan could not attract the mind of the gopis. And the second is that even Krishna in the Narayan form could not attract the mind of the gopis. So then, Prabhupada, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is quoting a verse, and this verse was spoken by Narada Muni in the Lalita Madhav Natak, 150th verse. So it is explained that once Lord Krishna playfully manifested himself in Narayan with four victorious sands and a very beautiful form. The gopis saw this form, their ecstatic feelings were crippled. Like today we were discussing that the particular form of Krishna acts like a stimulant for particular rasa. So Krishna's form as a small child, it actually simulates vatsalya rasa. Within Krishna's form, here it is Narayan form. This Narayan form actually, it does not stimulate Madhuri rasa. In fact, the feelings of Madhuri rasa became crippled by seeing the Narayan form. So, a learned scholar therefore cannot understand the gopis' ecstatic feelings, which are firmly fixed upon the original form of Krishna, the son of Nanda Maharaj. The wonderful feelings of the gopis in ecstatic paramarasa with Krishna constitute the greatest mystery in the spiritual life. The greatest mystery in the spiritual life. So in this way, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, actually, after completely convincing Venkata Bhatta, after deflating the pride of Venkata Bhatta, just to make him happy, and then he started speaking. So we can see Mahaprabhu's sensitivity. So this comes in so many instances in his dealing with Sarvam Bhattacharya, in Prakashanand Saraswati, in his defeating Keshav Kashmiri, here also with Venkata Bhatta. Dukkana Bhavika Bhatta Kailu Parihasa Shastra Siddhanta Shuna Yate Vaishnava Vishwasa.
The Lord pacified Venkat Bhat by saying, actually, whatever I have said is by way of jest. Now, you can hear from me the conclusion of the Shastras, in which every Vaishnava devotee has firm faith.
So far, Mahaprabhu explained based on actually rasa, how Krishna is superior to the, Krishna Swami is superior to Narayan. But now, in order to pacify him, he will speak based on the Siddhanta that there is no difference between Krishna and Narayan. Just to pacify him. So he says that there is no difference between Krishna and Narayan. They are of the same form. And there is no difference between the gopis and the Lakshmi Devi. They are also of the same form. And the goddess of fortune enjoys the association of Krishna through the gopis. Through the gopi, they have the same form. It is therefore she is enjoying through the gopis. So one should not differentiate between the forms of the Lord, for such a conception is offensive. 155th verse. Eka Ishvara Bhaktera Dhyana Anurupa Eka Yei Vigraha Kare Nanakara Rupa.
There is no difference between the transcendental forms of the Lord. Different forms are manifested due to different attachments of different devotees. Actually, the Lord is one, but he appears in different forms just to satisfy his devotees.
So he says that Anurupa, according to the different attachments of different devotees, Lord manifests different form. There is no, you should not differentiate between the two forms. So the main point of this particular purport is that Prabhupada essentially gives two conclusions. He says that one should not differentiate between two forms of the Lord. When you differentiate between the different forms of the Lord, it is considered offensive. And second point he says is that when a person equates the form of the Lord with the form of demigods, then that is also considered offensive. So in the case of the form of the Lord with the demigods, there you should differentiate. But between the forms of the Lord, you should not differentiate. So if we differentiate between the forms of the Lord, it is considered offensive. But if you don't differentiate between the form of Krishna and the form of the demigods, then it is considered offensive. So there you should make differentiation. So this is the main conclusion of this purport. So Prabhupada explains in the purport, like sometimes when we chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, somebody asks the question, whom does this Ram refer to? So if a devotee says it refers to Balram, then the other person becomes offended. How can you say it refers to Balram, it refers to Ram? As if thinking that Balram is actually different from Ram. So he says that it does not matter whether one refers to Balram or Lord Ramachandra when chanting Hare Ram, for there is no difference between them. Then, however, it is offensive to think that Balram is superior to Ram or Ram is superior to Balram. Therefore, neophyte devotees do not understand the Shastri conclusion, and consequently, they unnecessarily create an offensive situation. So, Ishwaratve Beda Manile Haya Aparada. It is offensive for one to differentiate between the forms of the Lord. So, you mainly try to understand this. How Mahaprabhu is dealing with Venkata Bhatta. After developing a good relation with Venkata Bhatta, in a friendly manner, he is actually speaking to Venkata Bhatta, and first he establishes the form of Krishna as superior to Lord Narayan. And then after that, just so that in order to make him comfortable, in order to not to make him unhappy, he's speaking from the point of view of Siddhanta, that one should not differentiate between the two forms of the Lord. So then he gives an example, 156th verse. Manirjata vibhagena nila pitadi biryutaha rupa bedam avapnoti dhyana beda tatachutaha.
When the jewel known as Vaidurya touches various other materials, it appears to be separated into different colors, and consequently it forms also appear different. Similarly, according to the meditational ecstasy of the devotee, the Lord, who is known as Achyuta, the infallible one, appears in different forms, although he is essentially one.
So this is an analogy, just like Vaidurya gem. It appears to be of different colors. In the form of Krishna, it actually appears to be a different, but actually is essentially one. Then Venkata Bhatta is giving a response in 5 verses. He says that I am an ordinary living entity, and you are the Supreme Lord, and whatever you say, I accept as the truth. So this is very similar to the Gita verse where Arjuna says that Sarvam Meda Tridam Manye Enmam Vadasi Keshava Nahite Bhagavan Vyaktim Vidur Devana Dhanava. The 10th chapter, 10.14. So Prabhupada is quoting the same verse. So Vaidurya Mani, it's like Vaidurya, the analogy is that Vaidurya appears to be separated into different colors, but it actually is one. It appears to be of different colors, but actually it is only one. Similarly, according to the ecstasy of the devotee, the Lord appears in different forms, but although he is essentially one. Then Venkata Bhatta says that actually I have been engaged in the service of Lakshmi Narayan, and because of their mercy, I have been able to see your lotus feet. Just like that Brahmana also said that by following the instruction of spiritual master, I was studying Gita, and by the mercy of Krishna, now I am able to understand that you are non-different from Krishna. Similarly, he is also saying. So out of your causeless mercy, you have told me the glories of Krishna. No one can reach the end of the opulence qualities and forms of the Lord. So now I can understand that devotional service unto Krishna is the supreme form of worship. So Mahaprabhu told how there is no difference between the different forms of the Lord just to pacify Venkata Bhatta. But Venkata Bhatta is coming to the conclusion. Devotional service to Krishna is superior to the devotional service to Lord Narayan. Out of your causeless mercy, you have made my life successful simply by explaining the facts. then he fell down before the lotus feet of the Lord, and then Mahaprabhu embraced him. So then the Chaturmasya completed. Mahaprabhu wanted to leave Srirangam, but Venkata Bhatta did not wanted to. He also wanted to go along with the Lord. Somehow with a great endeavor, Mahaprabhu bade him farewell. So Venkata Bhatta fell down unconscious. Then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu proceeded from Srirangam. Then the next place, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, or the next place which is described is that Mahaprabhu came to Rishabha Hill.
There seems to be no mention about any initiating him into.
This is maybe not be diksha, I think. I'm not aware of that. What is mentioned in the other books?
Gopal Bhatta Goswami becomes a full-fledged follower later on, and Prabhudana Saraswati, who was uncle of Gopal Bhatta Goswami, he also becomes very staunch follower. Venkata Bhatta seems to have cultivated a very deep relationship with Lord because he's fainting unconscious. And he has also accepted the conclusion. Doesn't seem to be any initiation.
Definitely, I think he must have been initiated by Sri Vaishnav, usually, because he was the Sri Sampradaya. In order to worship Lakshmi Narayan, they have to be initiated. So he must have got from Sri Sampradaya Guru. But Mahaprabhu gave the higher transcendental knowledge. He gave that shiksha of the higher transcendental knowledge. In that sense, you can say he acted as a shiksha guru. Then Mahaprabhu comes to Rishabha Hill. So, I don't know if anybody was present in 2005. No, Rishabha Hill is near Madurai. That Aragar Koil and that place. In 2005 Yatra, we had gone. 2005 South India Yatra, we had gone to this Rishabha Hills. So the Rishabha Hill is the same place where Lord Rishabhadev burned himself to ashes. It is actually just near Madurai city. That's a beautiful temple is there. So there Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to Rishabha Hills, and there Chaitanya Mahaprabhu met Paramananda Puri. So Paramananda Puri is the god brother of Ishwara Puri. So Mahaprabhu, Paramananda Puri was staying there for the Chaturmasya period. So Mahaprabhu paid respects to him, and then he spent 3 days with Paramananda Puri discussing topics of Krishna. Then Paramananda Puri told Chaitanya Mahaprabhu his plan to visit Jagannath Puri. Then Mahaprabhu told him that Paramananda Puri said that I plan to visit Jagannath Puri from here. And then from there, Jagannath Puri, I am planning to go to Bengal in order to take bath in the Ganges. Then Mahaprabhu requests Paramananda Puri that please, after visiting Bengal, please again come back to Jagannath Puri. I will actually return to Jagannath Puri, and then we can spend time together in Jagannath Puri discussing about Krishna.
The 82nd verse commentary that Vishnu Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that Tridandi Ramanu Ji Arya Swami, that Prabhudananda Saraswati. Tridandi Ramanu Ji Arya Swami, like that.
Achcha. He was initiated by as a sannyasi in the Sri Sampradaya. That's what you're saying.
Tridandi Ramanu Ji Swami.
Okay. Maybe later he became the follower of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He was a disciple of Prabodhananda Saraswati.
In the other places I remember that they said like that.
Then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after his request to Paramananda Puri, then Mahaprabhu took his leave, and then he departed further to South India. So then he came to Sri Shaila. So here it is explained, Sri Shaila is actually, it came previously also. The Sri Shaila, Mallikarjuna Tirtha, the Jyotirlinga which is there, the It's actually in Karnataka. So the purport Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that actually it's not possible because Madurai is like very further, very down south. It's not, Sri Shaila is like very far from Madurai. So he explains that so Sri Shaila is somewhere near Belgaum, just near Belgaum. So therefore, it's not in a chronological order. So anyway, he describes that Mahaprabhu came to Sri Shaila, and there Lord Shiva and Durga Devi, they came in the dress like a Brahmana and Brahmani. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they gave alms to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu spent 3 days with them in a solitary place, and they talked very confidentially. And then after talking with Lord Shiva and Parvati, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to Kama Koshti Puri. So there is no explanation of what it actually, which place it means, Kama Koshti Puri. From Kama Koshti Puri, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu arrived at Madurai. So Rishabha Hills is actually the north of Madurai, just little near Madurai. Now it is described that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to Madurai, and Madurai he met a Brahmana. So that time is called as Southern Mathura, and the present day name is actually Madurai. In Madurai there are three main temples. One is the Sundareshwar temple, another the Rameshwar temple. These are the two Shiva temples. And the third temple is the Meenakshi temple. Especially, it is known for its architectural designs, because later the Muslims destroyed many parts of it. So then, there is an interesting pastime. So there was this Brahmana who was a great devotee of Lord Ram and an authority on Ramayana. So then, in Madurai, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu bathed at Kritamala River. So Kritamala, the present day name is actually Vaigai. There are four rivers which is mentioned in the 11th canto. Kaveri, Kritamala is Vaigai, Tamiraparani and Payaswini. So 11th canto Bhagavatam says that great devotees will take birth in the banks of these rivers, and one who drinks the waters of these rivers, they will develop love for the Lord. So Mahaprabhu took bath in the Kritamala River, and then after taking, so this Brahmana invited Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to take lunch in his house. So Mahaprabhu went to take bath, and then he came to the house. He saw that nothing was prepared, and so Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "Please tell me, like, why have you not cooked anything?" So then this Brahmana replied, "Actually, see, we are living in the forest. Unless Lakshman comes and brings fruits and vegetables and roots, then only after he brings, then Sita Devi will cook, then only we can eat." So Mahaprabhu, when he heard this reply, usually we hear that somebody has invited you for lunch and then nothing is prepared, he'll become angry. So Mahaprabhu, by hearing this reply, he was very satisfied with the worship of this Brahmana, like how he was absorbed in Ramayana. He was so much absorbed in Ramayana, he was thinking that he is living in the forest. He was waiting for Lakshman to come. So then Mahaprabhu was satisfied to hear the Brahmana's method of worship. And then finally the Brahmana realized, "Oh, I have not cooked." And then he hastily started making arrangements for cooking. And then in a hurry-burry he made something. And then at 3 o'clock, Mahaprabhu honored lunch. Then after Mahaprabhu honored lunch, then Mahaprabhu saw this Brahmana is still fasting. Then he asked, like, "Why are you fasting?" This Brahmana replied that I am very pained to see that Mother Sita has been touched by Ravan. Such a terrible act has happened. So I have no reason to live. In fact, I want to end my life by entering in either fire or water. So Mahaprabhu said, 188th verse. No. Chaitanya, 190th verse. Prabhu kahe ye bhavana na kariha ara. pandita hanakene nakarah vichara.
You are a learned pandit. Why don't you consider the case?
So then Mahaprabhu explains that actually Sita Devi is an eternal consort of the Lord. She has the body of Satchitananda Vigraha. She has a spiritual form of full bliss. What to speak of some ordinary materialistic conditioned soul touching her body, nobody can even see her body. So when Ravana appeared, actually Sita disappeared and the Agni Dev presented a Maya Sita and Ravana took up only that illusory form of Sita. So then 194th verse, this is an important verse. Aprakrita vastu nahe prakrita gochara Veda purane te ye kahe nirantara.
Spiritual substance is never within the jurisdiction of the material conception. This is always the verdict of the Vedas and Puranas.
So here, Mahaprabhu is saying that spirit is not within the jurisdiction of matter. So Ravana is a materialistic person. He can never actually touch Sita. So this purport is very important. These are some Vedic statements about spiritual substance. Spiritual substance cannot be seen by the unintelligent because they do not have the eyes or the mentality to see the spirit soul. So when people are not able to see the spirit soul, then they come to the conclusion that there is no soul only. There is nothing called a spirit soul. But the followers of the Vedic injunction take their information from the Vedic statements, such as the verses from the Katha Upanishad and the Srimad Bhagavatam quoted above. Yasyatma buddhi kunapetru dhatuke. Then Mahaprabhu assured the Brahmana, please have faith in my words and do not burden your mind with the anxiety, the misconception. So Prabhupada explains the importance of having faith in the bona fide Acharya. Then the Brahmana put faith in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then he finally accepted prasadam. Then Mahaprabhu left from there and then he came to the place called as Durvasana. Has anybody gone to this place, Durvasana? I think we had gone 2005 Yatra. After Rameshwaram, when we are coming, there's a Sri Vaishnava Divyas Desham is there. It's a beautiful temple of Lord Ram. So it's a place called as Durvasan, where he bathed again in the river Kritamala. So the Kritamala river has got three tributaries, Suruli, Varahanadi, and Batila Gundu. And there Mahaprabhu visited the temple of Lord Ram in the hill known as Mahendra Shaila. He saw Lord Parashuram. I think Durvasan, if I remember properly, it is the same place where Vibhishan came to surrender to Lord Ram. Vibhishan came to surrender to Lord Ram. So, there is mention of Mahendra Shaila in Ramayana. Then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went to Setu Bandha and then he took bath in the place called as Dhanush Teertha. And then he visited the Rameshwara temple. So when it is called Rameshwara, Rameshwara means Lord Ram, who is the worshipable deity of Lord Shiva. That is what it means, Rameshwara. So therefore, thus the Lord Shiva found in the temple of Rameshwara is a great devotee of Lord Ramachandra. So people usually say that, see, Lord Ram worshipped Lord Shiva. That means Lord Ram is superior to Lord Shiva is superior to Lord Ram. Lord Ram worshipped Lord Shiva, wanting to actually give the respect to his devotee, because he killed the follower of Lord Shiva, Ravan. He wanted to actually appease Lord Shiva. So another point which is explained is that, It said, Devi Pattanam Arabhya Gacheyu Setu Bandhanam. It is said that one should take darshan of Lord Shiva there after taking darshan of Durga Devi. Then one should go to Rameshwaram. So in Rameshwaram, if you go, there are some 12, I think how many tirthas? 21 tirthas. 24 wells are there. Has anybody gone, taken birth? So, when we, which yatra? 2009 yatra have we went there. There are 24 tirthas are there. And of course, the Dhanush Tirtha is situated some miles away from Rameshwaram. And it is said in Dhanush Tirtha, if a person takes bath there, one will be liberated from the cycle of birth and death. And one who bathes there gets all the fruity results of performing the yajna known as Agnishtoma. Then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in the Rameshwaram temple, he saw that some Brahmanas were discussing Kurma Puran. And when he saw, he heard that they were discussing certain verses from Kurma Puran, which mentioned how the Sita which was taken by Ravana was actually the Maya Sita and not the original Sita. And Saraswati Thakur explains that actually right now only 2 chapters of Kurma Puran is available. So originally Kurma Puran contains 17,000 verses. So presently only some 6,000 verses are available. So Mahaprabhu, the verses from Kurma Puran which give proof for how Ravan took only the Maya Sita, that is explained. So then what Mahaprabhu did is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after he heard the story, he was very pleased. And then he remembered this Ramdas Vipra, that Brahmana in Madurai. And then he made a copy of that Kurma Puran and he gave that copy to the Brahmanas and he took the original Kurma Puran. And Mahaprabhu was supposed to go to some other place, but instead of going to the next place, he again returned to Madurai. Just to actually convince this Brahmana more thoroughly by presenting the original scripture Kurma Puran and showing this evidence from this verses from the Kurma Puran to show that Ravan took only the Maya Sita. So when Maharaj was narrating this pastime in, I think, 2005 Yatra, was saying that he met this Professor Larson in Butler, Pennsylvania. Professor Larson, it comes in Chaitanya, the Prabhupada Leelamrit. So when Maharaj met Professor Larson, so Professor Larson showed the Srimad Bhagavatam copies which he purchased from Prabhupada. And Prabhupada had actually given an autograph in there. So Maharaj said, we also followed in the footsteps of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So we gave one original full Bhagavatam set of 18 volume and then we took that that copy from Professor Larson exchanged with that. So similarly here Mahaprabhu took the original Kurma Puran and he gave one the copy of Kurma Puran to those Brahmanas. So that verses are explained, 211th verse. You can read the 211th verse translation.
When he was petitioned by Mother Sita, the fire god Agni brought forth an illusionary form of Sita and Ravana, who had 10 heads, kidnapped the false Sita. The original Sita then went to the abode of the fire god. When Lord Ramchandra tested the body of Sita, it was the false, illusionary Sita that entered the fire. At that time, the fire god brought the original Sita from his abode and delivered her to Lord Ramchandra.
So then when this Brahmana heard this, he immediately fell down at the feet of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then he said that actually, you are the same Lord Ramachandra. And now you have come in the dress of a sannyasi to give me audience. And in this way, he expressed his gratitude. And then he said that previously, I could not offer you proper lunch. Now please come, I will cook proper prasadam for you. And then he requested Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to come. And then Mahaprabhu took prasadam and then first class dinner was offered to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then Mahaprabhu passed that night in the house of the Brahmana. And then Mahaprabhu went towards Tamrabharani river in the Pandya Desh. So Tamrabharani is also called as Purunai. So then he came to the place called as Navatirupati. It is actually near Trinalveli. There are 9 Divya Desham temples of Sri Sampradaya are there. It is said that in one particular day in a year, all the 9 deities assembled together for an yearly festival in the town. Then Mahaprabhu came to a place called as Chityadatala or Cheratala. Which place is it? Anybody? Cheratala. And then he came to the place called as Tenkasi. Tenkasi is there in south, near Tirunelveli. Kutralam. So. So Mahaprabhu came to these places. From there he came to the place called as Gajendra Mokshan. The Gajendra Mokshan, it is a place near the present day city called as Nagarkoil. Nagarkoil.
Same place.
He came to Gajendra Mokshan place. It is said that the Gajendra Mokshan temple is sometimes mistaken for a temple of Lord Shiva. Actually, the deity is not of Shiva but of Vishnu. Then Mahaprabhu came to a place called as Panagadi, which is called as Pannakudi right now. Which is also near Tirunelveli. And there Mahaprabhu came to a temple of Lord Ramachandra. But later that Lord Ram deity was taken away. And then they replaced the deity with the Lord Shiva deity. That is just a historical thing. 222nd verse. Chamtapure Asideki Shri Rama Lakshmana. Shri Vaikunte Asi Kaila Vishnu Darashana.
Later, the Lord went to Chamtapur, where he saw the deities of Lord Ramchandra and Lakshmana. He then went to Sri Vaikunta and saw the temple of Lord Vishnu there.
So, Chamtapur is called as Chengannur. It is in Kerala. And he also came to a place called as Sri Vaikunta. It is also near Tirunelveli. Then Mahaprabhu came to Malaya Parvat and offered prayers to Agastya Muni. So, there are 4 opinions about Agastya Muni. First is that there is a temple of Agastya Muni in the village of Agastyampalli in the district of Tanjore. And second, there is a temple of Lord Skanda on a hill known as Shivagiri. And this temple is said to have been established by Agastya Muni. And third, some say that the hill near Cape Comorin known as Patiya served as Agastya Muni's residence. And fourth is there is a place known as Agastya Malaya, which is a range of hills on both sides of Tamaravarni River. Then Mahaprabhu came to Cape Comorin or Kanyakumari. So there Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to Amli Tala, where he saw the deity of Lord Ramachandra. Then he came to the place known as Mallar Desh, where the community of Bhattaharis lived. So Prabhupada gives a brief information about Bhattaharis. Bhattaharis are some nomadic communities who would actually move from one place to another place. They would actually dress themselves as sannyasis, but their main business is cheating and stealing. They would allure some young men, and they would allure the young men to join their camps. In this way, they would actually increase their population of the community. And he says that actually all over the world there are nomadic communities whose business is simply to allure, cheat and steal innocent women. So after visiting Mallar Desh, Mahaprabhu went to Tamala Kartika, where there is a temple of Lord Kartikeya. And then he visited actually Betapani. There he saw the temple of Lord Ram and he passed that night there. So there is a pastime which comes, the purport I think it will be taken tomorrow, which comes later. But it is explained that when Mahaprabhu was there in that place, this Bhattaharis somehow influenced the mind of Kala Krishnadas. And they somehow influenced him and they made him join his camp. So So then when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to know, he immediately went there just to find Kala Krishnadas. And he asked the Bhattaharis, you are also sannyasis, I am also a sannyasi. Why are you keeping my Brahmana assistant? I am in the renounced order of life and so are you. You are purposefully giving me pain and I do not see good logic in this. When Mahaprabhu said, upon hearing Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Bhattaharis, they actually came with their weapons in order to attack Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, but to their surprise, with their weapons, they attacked themselves. And the other people saw that they were getting attacked themselves, so everyone became afraid and they started actually running in different directions. Then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took Kala Krishnadas by his shika and then took him away. 234th verse. Seidina chali aila payasvini tire snanakari gela adi keshava mandire.
That very night, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his assistant, Krishnadas, arrived at the bank of the Payaswini River. They took their bath and then went to see the temple of Adi Keshav.
So then Mahaprabhu, now in Kerala, he visited three temples. He took bath in the Payaswini River and this Adi Keshav temple and Anantapad Padmanabha temple. And there is a third temple of Janardhan Swami, in a place called as Varkala. So these three temples, so we had visited these temples after 2005 South India Yatra for 2 days. There's the Brahmachari who visited these temples. I think 2009 also visited Ananta Padmanabha and Adi Keshav. We visited, I think, yeah, Varkala we did not go 2009. So that comes now. It comes here. That was Kurma Puran. That's when Kaviraj Goswami gave the summary that he mentioned. So in the Adi Keshav temple, Mahaprabhu took darshan of the Lord Vishnu temple. There's a long, very huge deity of Lord Vishnu, lying down in the bed of Anantasesh. Then Mahaprabhu discussed the spiritual matters with the highly advanced devotees, and there he found a chapter of the Brahma Samhita. And he was so happy to find a chapter of that scripture, and symptoms of ecstatic transformation, trembling, tears, perspiration, trance and jubilation were manifest in his body. So just by seeing that chapter, so 239th verse. Siddhanta Shastra Nahi Brahma Samhita Rasama Govinda Mahima Gyanera Parama Karana Alpakshare Kahe Siddhanta Apara Sakala Vaishnava Shastra Madhye Atisara.
There is no scripture equal to the Brahma Samhita as far as the final spiritual conclusion is concerned. Indeed, that scripture is the supreme revelation of the glories of Lord Govinda, for it reveals the topmost knowledge about him. Since all conclusions are briefly presented in the Brahma Samhita, it is essential among all the Vaishnava literature.
So, Prabhupada, Brahma Samhita is such an important book that Bhaktivedanta Saraswati Thakur has given a commentary, and then there is a very elaborate commentary of Jiva Goswami and Brahma Samhita. There's an elaborate commentary of Jiva Goswami. It's a beautiful. So Prabhupada gives a brief description of what is there in the Brahma Samhita. Brahma Samhita contains the methods of devotional service, 18 syllable Vedic hymn, discourses on the soul, super soul, fruitive activity, and explanation of Kama Gayatri. It explains the demigod Ganesh, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, origin of Gayatri Mantra, the form of Govinda, the highest goal, the goddess Durga, the meaning of austerity. The steps of devotional service are also explained. So all these subjects are, it also describes the truth about Lord Vishnu, prayers, Vedic hymns, Lord Shiva, Vedic literature, personalism and impersonalism. All these subjects are conclusively explained in a nutshell in Brahma Samhita. So Mahaprabhu copied the Brahma Samhita. Here I think he didn't take the original copy. He just copied the Brahma Samhita with great pleasure. He went to the next place, Ananta Padmanabhaswamy temple. And then he came to Janardhan temple. He took darshan of Janardhan Swami. And then he stayed there for 2 days. And then he went to the bank of the Payaswini river and visited the temple of Shankar and Narayan. Then he arrived at Sringeri. Shringeri mate aila Shankaracharya sthane. Matsya tirtha deki kaila Tungabhadraya snane.
Then he saw the monastery known as Sringeri Math, the abode of the Acharya Shankara. He then visited Matsya Tirth, a place of pilgrimage, and took a bath in the river Tungabhadra.
So we'll conclude this verse. So this is a description of Sringeri Math. It's explained that how Shankaracharya had 4 principal disciples. Their names are explained later in the purport. Padmapad, Sureshwar, Hastamalaka, and Throtaka. So Shankaracharya established 4 mutts in Badrinath, Dwarka, and Jagannath Puri, and in Sringeri. So these 4 mutts were established by Shankaracharya. And all these, in the Sringeri mutt, the sannyasis designations are Saraswati, Bharati, and Puri. They are all Tridanda sannyasis. And it is explained that Sringeri Math is a portion of the country comprising Andhra, Dravida, Karnataka and Kerala. The community is called Buri Rava and the dynasty is called Bur Bhuva. And their slogan is Aham Brahmasmi. And there are so many lists of the different sannyasis which come in the Shankaracharya Sampradaya that is explained. And then he gives a brief history of Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya was born in actually Kaladi. His father's name was Shivaguru, but his father left his body in a very young, when Shankaracharya was very only 8 years old. Then Shankaracharya took sannyas from Govinda, and after accepting sannyas, he stayed with the spiritual master for some days, and then he went to Varanasi, and from there he went to Badrikashram. There he wrote commentary on Brahma Sutra, Bhagavad Gita and Upanishads. And he also wrote other commentaries on Narasimha Thapani Upanishad, Sanat Sujatiya, etc. So then he initiated these 4 disciples. So then when he came to, after departing from Varanasi, Shankaracharya came to Prayag. So there he wanted to have a debate with a person called as Kumarila Bhatta. That time Kumarila Bhatta was very old. He was in the deathbed. So he told Shankaracharya to debate with his disciple called as Mandan Mishra. So Shankaracharya had a debate with Mandan Mishra, and Mandan Mishra's wife was she acted like a jury to declare who will be the winner. So then Shankaracharya actually defeated Mandan Mishra in the debate. And like Mandan Mishra's wife, she declared, oh, Shankaracharya is the winner. But because she had affection towards her husband, she wanted to defeat Shankaracharya. So she said that, I want to argue with you on the subject of Shringar Ras. Knowing that Shankaracharya would have, because he has no experience of Shringar Ras. He is a sannyasi from a young age. So I will be easily able to defeat Shankaracharya. So when she said that, Shankaracharya has agreed to the debate, but he said that, I just want some time from you. I will argue with you after 1 month. And then he took leave. So then Shankaracharya, he took leave and then he entered the body of a king who had just died. And then he entered that body, and then he became a king, and then he actually dealt with the queen of the king, and he understood all the intricacies of the Shringar Ras. And after that, he actually left that body, and then again he came as Shankaracharya, ready to actually debate with this wife of Mandan Mishra. But it is explained that when Shankaracharya came back, so then this wife of Mandan Mishra, she, even without hearing his discussion, she blessed Shankaracharya and assured the continuous existence of the Sringeri Math. The wife of Mandan Mishra is called as Ubaya Bharati. So Shankaracharya wanted to discuss with her, but Ubaya Bharati, without hearing his discussion, she blessed him and assured the continuous existence of Sringeri Math. She then took leave of the material life. So afterwards, Mandan Mishra became the disciple of Shankaracharya, and he became known as Sureshwar. So in this way, Shankaracharya defeated many scholars throughout India and converted them to his Mayavad philosophy. And Shankaracharya left his material body at the age of 33. So we'll stop here. You had some point. So tomorrow, I think, we'll continue and then complete this chapter and proceed ahead.
That verse appearing in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and Rupa Goswami later added it. So there, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says this, and one more point he just adds that in many places, that Kaviraj Goswami, he understanding the mood, he himself, he added some Goswami's verses there in between the conversations.
Oh, acha, acha.
In this case, he both tells both things. One is like this, and he said many other places also it happened like this.
Okay, okay. This is sometimes Kaviraj Goswami, understanding the mood of the characters, he adds some verses. Okay. Shri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki jai.